it sounds like it's quieted down elsewhere, so I'm taking that to mean that everybody's in, they said 7:45 is our next chat, so.
Let's
start it. Let's chat. So I'm Lori Burkholz, for those of you who maybe don't know who I am. I joined Dr. Margaret Dupree in her practice about a year and a half ago. My background is primary care. I did residency in family medicine, and I then followed that with a fellowship in women's health. And within that fellowship, my focus included midlife menopausal medicine, cancer survivorship, and sexual medicine. So my practice fit very well with Dr. Dupree's, coming from her background of gynecology and obviously her interest in midlife health and my background of family medicine and primary care. So we had a really good partnership going, and that continues to grow and improve. And so they asked me tonight to come and talk about cancer survivorship. And I think one of the first things to note is what is the definition of a cancer survivor? And then once we sort of have that definition, what is survivorship medicine? Why do we have survivorship medicine, in this day and age, actually a field of medicine, a subspecialty, if you will. And so there are multiple different definitions for a cancer survivor. And quite frankly, there are some people who don't even like the word survivor. And there are other terms, alternative terms that can be used, like aliver or thriver. And I think that of them, I like the term thriver. I think it really speaks to what we get at in survivorship medicine, which is living well, being healthy, optimizing health and wellness. But probably the most widely accepted definition of survivorship or a cancer survivor is any individual from the time of diagnosis to the time of death who has been given a diagnosis of cancer. Okay. Slightly broader definition that I typically would consider in my practice would include anybody that's in the immediate circle of those people who have been diagnosed. Okay, so close friends, family, loved ones, who are certainly themselves not going through the physicality of the treatment, but nonetheless have physical and emotional effects from being so near to that person diagnosed. So from the time of diagnosis and beyond, that person and any of those people who are still very close, that they're clearly going to be affected by the diagnosis and the treatment. As of January 1st, 2012, there were nearly 14 million survivors defined by those individuals with diagnosis. Okay. 14 in the United States, 14 million people diagnosed. So that's why we have this entire field of survivorship medicine, because 4% of the population having been diagnosed with cancer. The vast majority of those survivors are survivors of breast cancer, colorectal cancer, and prostate cancer. But breast cancers make up the largest proportion.
More than prostate.
More than prostate. Yeah. Part of that might be because a lot of prostate cancers aren't detected. So there's a quote that most men die with prostate cancer, not of prostate cancer, because we think that there's just a lot of indolent. Now, nobody's done that study on women to really be able to discern, are there women who have DCIS or the early sort of stages of breast cancer in their breast, or nobody's really done those studies yet. But so it may not be that there's necessarily more breast cancer than prostate cancer. It's just that defined survivors, there's plenty more breast survivors. So, and why is that? Why are we saying 14 million? I think it was a writer. In 2007, it was 11 million. If you go back a little further, it was fewer. So it's projected that in 5 years, in 2018, we'll have 18 million survivors, and the numbers just keep getting bigger and bigger. And it's for several reasons. We've gotten really good at detecting cancer at very early stages.
on stage one, stage two, where we know survival rates. You know, breast cancer diagnosed in stage one is 90% survival at the 5-year mark. But that's because we're doing mammograms, it's because we are doing MRIs. Our detection is only going to get better as we now start to recognize the role of genetic testing and really being able to start thinking about other modes and mechanisms of screening so that we're catching these women so early. We've gotten better at treating cancer. And so whereas we used to use therapies that were incredibly toxic and really not all that great, we now have this, you know, incredible army, if you will, of treatment options that range from chemotherapies to radiation therapies. Our surgical techniques have gotten much better. You know, some of you are probably well aware, years ago, there was no such thing as a lumpectomy. If you had just a little tiny little blip of breast cancer, not only did the breast pump, but the muscles behind it, everything, I mean, the term radical mastectomy. And with that comes a lot of morbidity and mortality. And so we've just gotten much better at treating. Now, the flip side of that is that all of these therapies do a great job of treating breast cancer, but they also do a good job of putting women into menopause, causing hot flashes, causing night sweats, causing sexual health changes related to vaginal dryness, causing joint pain, causing fatigue, weight gain, keep going on and on. And so that's where the field of survivorship medicine comes in. I think sort of a mantra within survivorship medicine is our job is not necessarily to help women live longer, but to help women live as long as they can, as well as they can. Okay? So it's about recognizing that it's more than just quantity, it's quality. And we've got all these great therapies, but they sometimes have side effects. And what can we do to optimize a woman's health and wellness, to really optimize her quality of life, so that all of those years that she has to look forward to after this diagnosis are good years? Are years doing things that she wants to do? And so that's where the field of survivorship medicine, I think, really takes its hold, as saying we want to make women live for as long as possible. There are different ways to look at that. Nutrition is certainly part of survivorship medicine, starting from the time you're diagnosed. What are the types of foods that you can eat to energize your body and help you get through your therapies? What are the types of foods that we recommend you eating afterwards to reduce your risk of recurrence? Things like the cruciferous vegetables, I know Dr. Cuthbert mentioned, talked about. But more than just helping you to sort of be able to say, I'm eating well and that's good for me, it's empowering to know that the choices you make when you're standing there looking in your refrigerator may reduce your risk. It's empowering to know that. But those are also the same foods that are going to reduce your risk of heart disease. And quite frankly, what I tell most women who come into my office is depending upon your stage of cancer, you're more likely to die of heart disease than you are of breast cancer. So we have to think about all of those other health risks that still remain when talking about breast cancer. I think another important point is bone health. And recognizing that some of the therapies that women go through, if a woman is young, under the age of 40, and goes through menopause as part of her breast cancer treatment, she's at very high risk for having weakening of her bones that might lead to osteoporosis. That's typically something that we're seeing in women in their late 60s and 70s having hip fractures. Well, what a tremendous effect on quality of life if I've got a woman now in her 50s who has had loss of her bone mass because of early menopause. On top of that, some of the therapies, the aromatase inhibitors, things like Arimidex, anastrozole, aromathin, can further that risk of bone loss. So we want to make sure not that we say to women, you can't be on that medicine or you shouldn't take that medicine, but what can you do to help support you and keep you healthy while you're on that medicine? So we address those side effects. I think another important job that I've found, a role that I've found myself playing, is helping women to sort of be able to weigh the risk or the side effects that occur from being on medication and the benefit of being on that medication. Dr. Dupree and I were having a conversation earlier today about a patient who had had a bilateral mastectomy. She had chemotherapy. She had radiation. Her risk of recurrence was significantly lower because of those choices that she had made as far as her therapy. And she was put on one of the medications that helps to block estrogen production. She was having a lot of side effects and was really quite uncomfortable. In helping her to understand how much further reduction in your risk of recurrence do you get from being on this medication, which her risk was already reduced to about less than 3% chance of having cancer ever come back. Being on this medication reduced her risk by 50%, which sounds like a huge number, but 50% of 3 is 1.5. And so saying, for you, does that additional 1.5% risk reduction, is that worth joint pains, hot flashes, vaginal dryness, fatigue, whatever the combination? In no way am I suggesting that it's not, because that's not for me to decide. That's for each of my patients to decide. But we don't always give our patients the opportunity to decide that. There was a really good article that I came upon just recently, September 21st. This journalist interviewed a woman who's a geriatrician. So her medical practice has been taking care of elderly and people who are at the end of life or coming near end of life. And she was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer. And she chose not to undergo the rigorous treatments that were recommended to her by her specialist in the field of, she has inflammatory breast cancer, which is the most rare breast cancer, but extremely aggressive, oftentimes stage 4 when it's diagnosed. And she chose not to go through those therapies. And I'm just going to read you a couple of clips because I think she's just really eloquent in her description. But she says, when I was diagnosed, I had some sense of what could be possible and what was most important to me. For me, it's all about holding on to function and quality of life, having a good life for as long as possible. And so she goes on to say, though, you know, so what, the interviewer asked her, what have you done that's different than most? And she just goes on to describe, most people go to their clinician, their doctor, their nurse, their nurse practitioner, or whoever. Most people go to their clinician and they wait to be told what to do. Not educated about the options and what's best for you, but here's the box of estrogen positive, stage 1 breast cancer. This is what you get to choose from. Not really saying, here's your diagnosis, here's your prognosis if we do nothing. Here's your prognosis if we do this, if we do this, if we do this. What are your goals? What do you want moving forward? Let you decide. Respect that most of our patients, and I say most because some people do need a little bit more guidance, but most of our patients are educated adults, men and women, who when given the information can really decide what's best for them. And I think as a patient, you feel more empowered in doing that. I know my patients are much more likely to be the medical room and be compliant if they have had a role in deciding what's best for them. And again, it doesn't mean that everybody makes the same choice. That's not at all what it means. It means that each person makes a choice that's right for them. I may agree with it or I may not agree with it. But again, if I feel that my patient is educated and understands, that's really the goal of that. So I thought that was sort of an interesting way to sort of look at it, that most people do just, wait, and it's a scary time when you're given that diagnosis. And I think it's good to have some guidance But again, it's good to be given the information so that you can really look to help you make those choices. She says, my goal is to live as well as possible for as long as possible. As well as possible. And apparently when she was giving this interview, again, she's 3 years into a diagnosis of stage 4. They describe her as energetic, vibrant, she's still working. She just vacationed at the Great Wall of China. And she had a grandchild, I think was the other thing, she had a grandchild come into her life that she's been able to take care of and play with. And she said, and she made a notice of that she may not have been able to do some of those things. She probably would not have been able to do those things if she would have. But more importantly, she said to her doctor, what did she say this? Somewhere she basically says that he told her all of these things that he was going to do, and in the end, it wasn't going to make a difference. But she had to ask him that. We're going to do chemotherapy, we're going to hit you hard, 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 we're going to do surgery. I wish I could find the exact quote, but that was pretty much what. We're going to hit you hard, 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 then we're going to do surgery, then we're going to hit you with more chemotherapy, and then you'll have radiation therapy. And she said, is this really going to change the outcome? In other words, she had stage 4 cancer. Is it going to cure her? Is she going to die from this, or is she not? And he basically said, no, it's not going to change her outcome. And I've been in situations where patients push further and their doctor says, well, it might give you an additional 1, 2, or 3 years. But the next question is, how am I going to feel for those additional 1, 2, or 3 years? And again, thankfully, when we're talking about breast cancer for so many women, we're talking about far more than that. We're talking hopefully about 10, 20, 30, 40 more years. But all the more reason it's important to know that you're going to feel good during those years. You know, we've started to get more concerned. I mentioned heart disease earlier. There's very good literature that says women who go through menopause under the age of 40 and lose estrogen at a young age are at increased risk for having heart attacks and strokes. So now we're taking women who are potentially under the age of 40, having breast cancer, taking away their estrogen for the rest of their lives, and we've reduced their risk for breast cancer recurring, but we've increase their risk of dying from heart disease. Is that an okay trade-off? Well, maybe, and maybe for some. But I've had patients where I look and their mom died of a heart attack when she was 62. And they have high cholesterol and they have all of these risk factors that suggest that the bigger concern is their heart. Again, not to minimize the issue of the breast, but when we put it into perspective and we remember that each woman is more than just a pair of boobs, that there's heart and brain and joints and potential partners and intimate relationships and all of these other things that somebody has to be thinking about and paying attention to. I think it's about really optimizing our health and wellness, looking at the importance of what we eat every day. Again, Dr. Cockerell talked about that, recognizing that you have decisions and your decisions do affect not only your risk for recurrence, but your overall health and how you feel, the importance of exercise and weight maintenance. I have a lot of patients who come concerned about weight gain after a diagnosis of breast cancer. That can certainly be related to many issues. And oftentimes, you know, we look back and we say, for the last 12 to 18 months, you have been through hell and back. You are fatigued and exhausted beyond belief, and you're not going to be as active, and there may be some weight gain. The days of cancer therapies causing severe nausea and wasting, you know, years ago, you would think somebody in cancer was, the term cachectic, or skinny, because they couldn't eat because they were so, no. We've gotten really good at getting chemotherapy drugs that don't cause near the nausea, and so instead, a lot of times we may eat more because of everybody's sort of comfort food, and so there's that factor. Women go through menopause and have hormonal changes. certainly that can affect their metabolism and their ability to maintain a healthy weight. Some of the medications may have a direct effect on weight. Well, that's what increases risk for breast cancer, postmenopausal weight gain. So we may be giving treatments or medications to reduce the risk, but a side effect is weight gain, which increases the risk. And you know, and of course we aren't so good that we can say, well, it reduces the risk this much and it only increases your risk this much. So, you know, we can't do that. We just know that there are lots of factors and we have to look at the bigger picture. So, but weight certainly is important. Alcohol intake, there's a factor that we know is related to breast cancer risk, and so I don't think anything like should be off the table. I think it's about moderation and recognizing that a little bit of anything is probably not harmful, a lot of anything is probably not good, and sort of moving forward in that direction. Sleep, so very important. And I think women struggle with sleep for, again, a number of reasons, starting when you have children and you learn to sort of always have one eye sort of open and one ear listening. And from there forward, I think we struggle to really get back to that place where you can get good sound sleep. But there are two of the therapies that we use to treat can cause insomnia, just the many thoughts that go through our mind all day long, the worry, anxiety that comes through. We need that time, we need that 7 to 8 hours to re-energize, to reboot, to help our immune systems function. And so sometimes it gets neglected, it's thought of as something that's not as important. But let me tell you, it is probably one of the most important aspects of the healing process, especially post-therapies, where your body's really striving to regain the strength and the energy that's been zapped. I want to make sure, because we have a few minutes left, to talk a little bit about intimacy and relationships. Another area that I oftentimes see overlooked, and not for any reason other than there's just a lot going on, and oncologists are really good at treating cancer. That's their job. We love that they're here. We love that they do that good job. But sometimes some of those other aspects aren't up at the forefront, and women and men alike are oftentimes a little uneasy to bring up the topic of intimacy, and a lot of doctors are uneasy bringing up the topic, and so it's sort of that elephant in the room that we know is there, but we may not talk about. Breast cancer specifically, there are different studies that look at the effects on relationships and intimacy, but it ranges anywhere from 50 to 90% that breast cancer survivors will have some negative effect on their intimate relationships because of that diagnosis. And there too, there are many reasons, depending upon the therapies that a woman goes through. Clearly, we all know that surgery, especially something like a mastectomy, but even a lumpectomy, changes our bodies, may change the way we feel about ourselves and our self-esteem. Women who don't have mastectomies but have a small lumpectomy and chemotherapy, it's going to change. We may lose our hair, or we may change our weight, we may gain weight, we may lose weight. I mean, they just feel exhausted and de-energized, and none of those things really conjure up sexy in our mind. So again, changing the way we feel about ourselves physically. Obviously, the therapies that women go through can affect. So women who have more significant surgeries can have lymphedema, which can affect the ability to lift the arms, to be able to hug or be near somebody in that physical manner. Medications that cause menopause, so chemotherapy drugs that cause a woman to go into menopause, and then some of those that we use after, more specifically, we are aromatase inhibitors, so Aromidex, Aromicin, and Estrazol. We know that those can cause really significant vaginal dryness and vaginal changes that can make any kind of penetrating, of course, to shaving and painful. And so we need to address that with patients because it's a time where we want to make sure that we can be close and supported by a partner. And it doesn't have to mean sex. It, again, might just mean a hug and being close in that way. But I always tell patients that a cancer diagnosis can make a relationship stronger and better. Unfortunately, a cancer diagnosis can have the opposite effect. And there's no way to tell outside of communication. And not only communicating between partners, but feeling that you have a good, strong support system of providers around you that you can talk to and help guide you through some of those challenges that come up. I think that kind of brings us to just a couple minutes left, and I was going to say I want to make sure
there are questions.
Yeah, absolutely.
As a, when you get to the point of being done with your therapies, does your practice that you're in, do you recommend getting genetic testing to determine whether reoccurrence is more apt and less apt?
So genetic testing, I wouldn't necessarily say is done for the purpose of recurrence as much as being able to determine if your risk of another primary cancer and or a cancer of a different organ. So specifically when we're talking about breast cancer, we're talking about the BRCA gene mutation, which is breast and ovarian cancer risk. And so there, typically we want to test, if we really have a strong suspicion that a woman may have a genetic predisposition, so her mom had cancer, her grandma, her mom's sister, and two cousins, or on the dad's side, all of dad's sisters and several cousins had breast cancer or ovarian cancer. That's information we actually want to know up front, because some women who know they have that genetic mutation, their risk for having breast cancer is so high that they choose to have a bilateral mastectomy as opposed to, let's say, the recommended surgery was just a lumpectomy. Having that information before surgery may help to direct the treatment, maybe more aggressive, or a woman may decide to be more aggressive. That would be an option that would be discussed. You know, if you have a stage one breast cancer and it's small, less than 2 centimeters, and the recommendation is we're just going to do a lumpectomy, that may be fine. But if you know, or we know, that the risk of your having another breast cancer is really high, then you may choose to do something more dramatic. Whereas a woman who has no genetic predisposition would probably not choose to have both breasts removed for that type of diagnosis. Some would, but. And then the ovaries. Then we also, you know, in those women who are known to have a gene mutation, talk about what type of screening is necessary for ovarian cancer. And some women choose to have the ovaries removed prophylactically, meaning there's nothing wrong with them now, but the risk of cancer is so high that we're going to take them out.
What would be a signal to have a genetic test?
That's a great question, and there's a little bit of debate about that depending upon who you ask. So, of course, like most things in life, up until just recently, there was really only one company that offered the genetic test, and they had a lot, I don't want to call it loose criteria, but there were a number of factors, a number of red flags that a woman may have that would suggest genetic testing. A lot of providers would say, we need to be a little bit more rigorous in who we recommend having that testing done. It's expensive, and just because we can do it doesn't mean we should do it, but I think probably the key red flags are the age. Okay, so women with the genetic mutation are likely to have cancer at younger ages. Mm-hmm. So, and typically we would say under the age of 50, but certainly women who are in their 20s and 30s, that's a big red flag for possible genetic mutation. Multiple breast cancers, so cancer in one breast and now diagnosed with cancer in the other breast, or a dual diagnosis of breast and ovarian cancer. The family history, not just mom's side, but dad's side too. Okay, so men carry the gene just like women do and can pass it along. But men are much, much, much less likely to have breast cancer, so you're not going to necessarily look for that. However, the family history of a man with breast cancer is highly suggestive of a genetic mutation. So if I have a woman who comes diagnosed with breast cancer and I hear that her dad or her uncle had a diagnosis of breast cancer, that's a big red flag that there could be a genetic mutation. And then I think it's just multiple family members.
Okay.
Interesting, I had a patient today and we were going through her family history and she had a maternal aunt and a maternal cousin both diagnosed with breast cancer. But her mom has 8 siblings, 6 of which are sisters, and only one of them had a breast cancer. And multiple cousins and only one. And so the fact that I know there are all those men out there within the same family that did not get breast cancer sort of suggests that it's probably not genetic, as opposed to if that patient said, my mom has one sister, and that sister had breast cancer, and that sister's daughter had breast cancer. There's that stronger lineage, if you will.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So those are probably the biggest things that we look for would be age, other diagnoses, so other breast or ovarian, and then that strong lineage when we look at the family history. We don't always have family history. People are adopted, you know, single children, those types of things, and so we have to look at the whole picture. But you know, I would say that most of our oncologists are really pretty good, and most of our surgeons too, because we want to have as much information that's pertinent to that person's diagnosis and treatment plan as possible up front. Again, if you're going to go to the operating room and go under anesthesia, we want to try to do as much as we can at one time. We don't want to have to bring you back 2 or 3 times because we keep getting more information as time goes on. Sometimes, invariably, that happens, but we want to be as prepared as possible.
I know one gal, she didn't want to take her tamoxifen because she ached terribly. And she's 70, she says, I can't take it. So the oncologist then said, well, then I don't have to follow up with you. Which was not very nice. So, would you follow up with these people?
I do. I have several patients who come to see me for their primary care. So
okay.
their primary care doctor.
So that's all she would need to follow up with, yeah. Basically, because mm-hmm. it was like the write-off, you know.
Yeah.
You don't do what I say, why then?
Yeah. And I don't think that's common. Thank goodness. But
I've heard more than once of those things. Yeah. So
the last patient said she. Not my last patient, excuse me, the last session, she said she had, I forget what she said her risk was. They told her she had a 0% risk of something and a 3 or 4% risk of something, and they put her on Lumidex and she was miserable and it was not the way she wanted to live. So she said she decided to just continue taking it, and she said, I felt like a naughty kid who had just been scolded or done something I wasn't supposed to do, and I thought, oh, that's so disappointing.
That's what this was.
You know, it was just her and her husband and parents, and I said, no, you need to respect your decision to know what's best for you. You need to trust that you know what's better for you than your doctor sometimes. Myself included. I'm sure I've made recommendations to patients, and I try to always say my job is not to tell you what to do, but to tell you what you can do, to give you the education, the information, and the options to make choices that are right for you. And quality of life is important. It is. I've had women who are estrogen positive breast cancer survivors who choose to continue on their estrogen therapy because they stop it and they are miserable. I had a woman who came in, she said, I'm going to get fired, I'm going to get divorced if I don't do something about this. This is no way to live. That's an extreme. Mm-hmm. Not everybody experiences that. But for her, we did the risk and the benefit, and she said, I would rather have 5 years of a good life than 10 years living the way that I am. Mm-hmm. This is just not... And again, everybody has a different sense of what they're okay with. I have women who will go to the ends of the earth, to hell and back, and do everything they can to reduce their risk to as low as possible, because for them, that's what helps them get through their days. They have the anxiety that they live with otherwise is too dramatic, and they're not living the way they want to live, and for them, they're going to do everything, and they're going to have side effects, but it's worth it to them. I have other women, again, who say, I can't do this. This is no way to live. And each person is different. Drugs affect each of us differently, so we can never predict what's going to happen. But I think it's, again, as women, feeling empowered to make decisions that are right for you and trusting your decision and not letting somebody treat you as if you've made the wrong decision. I think one of the most important things, and I didn't touch upon it, but another piece of survivorship medicine is that when women complete their treatment, they should have a good summary, a written summary of what their diagnosis was, what their treatments were, and what are the things that they need to do moving forward. If they are continuing to need mammograms, how often? Are they supposed to have MRIs, or are they supposed to have CT scans, or so how often? If you're on medication like tamoxifen, are you supposed to get eye exams? If so, how often? How often should you have a colonoscopy? If you're on Arimidex, have you had a bone density? How often should you have your bone density checked? What are some of the things to look for? If you had radiation to the left chest wall and you had a medication called Adriamycin or Herceptin, or heart conditions, knowing that so that in 15 years, if you start finding you're short of breath and you lie down and you can't climb your stairs with groceries, you and your doctor, who may not be your oncologist, now know, your cancer care plan, you had a medication that puts you at risk for this. I otherwise wouldn't think that a 50-year-old woman would be in heart failure, but because you had radiation to your left chest wall and you had two medications that are toxic to the heart muscles, I need to think about that, and it changes my plan, okay? Not all primary care doctors know that. That's why having that care plan that outlines that for you empowers you as a patient to know and allows you to share that with other doctors so that when you're dismissed from the oncologist's office, either because you hit that five-year mark or because you ticked him off, you know what you're supposed to do, and you can share that with your future physician. So that's an important part. It's called a cancer care plan.
Yeah.
No.
Can you go back to your oncologist
with that? You can call and just say, I was at a talk about survivorship, and she talked about a cancer care plan that outlined my diagnosis and treatment and the things I need to watch for along with my follow-up. I'd like a document. Not all doctors will do that, but they are supposed to.
Put your medications you had on there.
Exactly. So it tells me you had how much chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's important to know because some women have different types and may have more, and the more is not always the better when it comes to something like cardiotoxicity, heart damage. Tells me again, radiation, but where is it directed and how much radiation. A cancer care plan or a summary of your treatments and probably most importantly though, what is my follow-up? Because I so oftentimes have women come in and they don't know when or how many, do I need a mammogram still, do I get an MRI, do I get one or the other once a year, twice a year, do I need a CT scan, do I get, so it just helps so that you know. And that's just the breast cancer related. Again, I kind of gave you the example of women who are on aromatase inhibitors are at increased risk for bone loss and are supposed to have bone density scans before they start and then periodically after they have been on a medication. We typically wouldn't start that till a woman is 65. Okay. So again, doctors who may not recognize what those risks are, it's good for them to be able to look at that and say, okay, you're supposed to have this. Tamoxifen because ocular changes, so you're supposed to have eye exams with eye doctor at least once a year.
I was on Arimidex for 5 years, okay, and I struggled to complete that 5 years. And then about 3 years following that, now I'm almost 74 next month, and I have night flashes. I mean, just wow, what is this?
Yeah.
You know, and
Yeah, so it can be hormonally mediated. Mm-hmm. There can be other things that cause hot flashes and night sweats. Mm-hmm. So, important to follow up and make sure that it's not thyroid or infection. Yes, so make sure that your medication is at the right dose thing, some of those things. But
just really, what is this?
You think you're done, and then they come back. No, I think that's probably if anything that my patients complain of is that I thought I was done, and here they are.
I mean, I thought, this waist, I just think that's not crazy, I mean, I'm...